things I'd like to kind of ponder. I don't know if there's a talk in it, but I'll give it a go. One is in Buddhism, in Theravada Buddhism, the school I'm from, we have what we call Lokiya Dhamma and Lokuttara Dhamma. Dhamma means truth. Lokiya Dhamma is worldly considerations or mundane considerations, mundane Dharma, and Lokuttara is supramundane Dharma. So Lokiya Dhammas are the ways about how to live rightly in the world, about lifestyle, about livelihood, about speech, about relationships, about responsibilities. And Lokuttara Dhamma is about the inner world, the way it responds or reacts to life, and what in that inner world is suffering and what is the end of suffering. So one is kind of like lifestyle, and one is about how you're living your life inwardly. What's happening to you, the habits you have, the way to free your mind, how we get enslaved with things, all of that, which is very, very personal. In terms of Lokiya Dhamma, I think I'm going to start pushing Sabbath days. I thought I'd get on a crusade here. I think what's one of the great losses on our planet is the idea of Sabbath days, sabbatical, a day of rest, a day of stopping, no LCBOs open or whatever. Not just that, not just the sort of stopping of consumerism, but the stopping of this whole busyness of our culture, the whole sense of needing to do something and get something done, and this terrible difficulty we have in just taking stock of our own hearts and minds, learning to meditate, learning just to be with the trees and nature. And every great religious tradition has had that. So Islam, you have Ramadan now coming up. I was actually in Afghanistan during Ramadan. I was also in Morocco during one Ramadan before I became a monk. And I must say, everyone was quite grumpy because they couldn't eat during the day and so on. But the idea of whether it's Ramadan or the Jewish day of quietness on a Friday or the Poya day or the One Pra in Buddhism, Sunday, the Sabbath day, is this kind of time where we give a high priority to the spiritual side of our being, to the spiritual side of our nature. We make that a high priority. Our culture doesn't, I guess subcultures encourage it, a subculture of Christianity or a subculture of whatever might encourage it, but it's something that seems to be something that each person needs to somehow do for themselves. And I know many people speak of this. In Thailand, in the forest monasteries that I trained in northeast Thailand, every lunar quarter was called a One Pra, the day of the kind of holy day. And some of the villagers would come in the morning, they'd offer food, they'd stay in the monastery for the day. Monasteries are very open in Thailand. They'd meditate throughout the day. In the evening, or they take the 8 precepts in the morning. In the evening there'd be a discourse from teacher, and then all the monks and lay people would actually meditate right through to dawn, which was quite a powerful occasion actually. So these people, they're farming people, so they had the kind of flexibility of lifestyle, but every once a week the people who are really kind of committed would have this incredible long space of reflection and contemplation, and very healthy. Now I realize that doesn't seem to be possible in modern cultures, but to make that a priority I think is very healthy in terms of lifestyle. And in Buddhism we do talk about right lifestyle, because much of the things that we need to understand about our inner world are very subtle. They're quite subtle, and you need the kind of spaciousness and attention to understand them. And the time to refresh the heart and refresh the mind. So that's my little bid for a Sabbath day. If a Sabbath day is misunderstood and it's done out of a sort of sense of religious duty, or it can be misused. So But what was the original intention of that? Say, like in Islam, bowing five times a day. It's great, actually. You can stop five times a day and spend 5 minutes just bowing. It'd be great if the whole world just, you know, and did it sincerely, not out of fear or whatever, just did it really sincerely, just stop and reflect on Dharma or God or Allah or whatever you call your spiritual aspiration. Or if everyone really stopped on a Sunday or had a quiet day, I think the world would be more, you know, it could be a better place if it's done sincerely. So certainly in a monastery, as a Buddhist monk, we have that kind of a day where we come together. We, like every fortnight, we chant our rules, we recite our rules, we reflect on the teaching. And this idea of reflecting on the teaching again and again and again, whatever teaching you use, is important too, because we do forget. So that's that pitch. But what I really wanted to talk about, and I'm not sure if I can explain what I'm feeling, because this is a difficulty. One has a feeling about something, but it's sometimes hard to get into words. I've had the good fortune of being close to my mother the last few years, because she's elderly and I've got some space and time in my life. And so I've been able to be with her a lot. And what I've been contemplating is why or how or why does love go into worry? How does that most beautiful feeling we can have to a human being then become the most awful feeling? And we all have that, don't we? You know, your parent, child, your partner, whoever it is, you know, the sense of really caring for someone, loving someone, not being concerned about your own concerns, and being very open, the end of alienation, we might say, modern way of talking about it, that most profound feeling of love that we have, not just passion, but that sense of dropping a sense of I, and being attentive and empathetic and sensitive to others. There's that, and there's that other, that the worry, the fear of loss, the grief through loss. So it almost seems like, can I really love someone deeply and not worry? Can I love someone deeply and when they die not just fall into abject grief and depression? Well, the alternative, you know, must I live a cold life then? That would be awful, wouldn't it? You know, to live some kind of life of don't touch me because I might get hurt. Quite a risk, isn't it, loving someone because you might get hurt? And that's one way sometimes people will deal with those open-hearted feelings is sometimes people feel too sensitive or too vulnerable, whatever words we might use, and then they just kind of close down in cynicism and just kind of put a kind of veneer or wall of cold cleverness around them. That's not nice, is it? That's not very rewarding. And yet the other that mothers can very much worry about their kids, or sons can worry about their mothers. This is a very real thing. So I've been watching that a lot the last few years. And then part of this talk is maybe to indicate how if we have something like that, so this is something that's very important for me to understand, it's not going to come by reading a book. You know, some book might say this, this, and that, but I think the real heartfelt insight is going to come through observation. And I don't think it comes very quickly in the sense that one gets a kind of complete understanding of the problem by just noticing it once. I certainly haven't found that. Maybe I'm a bit slow, but I found that if there is some profound bit of my conditioning, my heart and my mind, that is affected by life in a strong way, I need to continually be in a situation where I can see that operating, repetition. That I find very helpful. So say with my mother, just being with her a lot the last few years, because before that I was just in Asia for many, many years, I just didn't never saw my parents, so I'm kind of making up for lost time for my mother. But just kind of seeing how my heart operates with her, like when I first came back from Asia, all the old memories and triggers were there with my mother and my brother and my father. I didn't understand anything. I just kind of survived. I was very, very confused because it was so strong, so powerful. But now over the years, just watching, what is it? How does it work? How does it work? What is it? And just kind of observing. I think that kind of practice one needs to bring into the really fundamental parts of our heart and our conditioning. So if you have a situation in your life which is repetitively painful, confusing, but it's not abusive and it's not immoral and it's not just overwhelming, then that is something that really needs to be paid attention to again and again and again in a kind of way of awareness. I was just reading a talk of Ajahn Chah. He said that you'll find the clean place in the dirty place. If you have a dirty kitchen counter, you find the clean kitchen counter where the dirty kitchen counter is, by cleaning the kitchen counter, right? So the solution to our heart's constrictions or our feelings of alienation lies in the alienation, doesn't it? The solution lies in the problem. In that, so if I dismiss it, or I don't look at it, or I distract it, or I repress it, or I blame it, I do all those strategies, then of course the heart can't realize its deep and profound possibility of deep love and deep wisdom. So one has to have the understanding that in these heartfelt difficulties that we experience as human beings, the solution lies. And where we miss that is when we think that the problem is a worldly problem. So I think that the problem is my mother's sickness or my mother's age. Well, it is and it isn't. Certainly, things she goes through in her old age are things that need to be addressed. But deeper than that, there's the problem of love, attachment, worry, fear, right? So I need to somehow extricate myself from the particulars and come to the general. And if I can't do that, then I'll just be worried about Mom. And then she'll die or I'll die. One of us will go, guaranteed. And both of us will go eventually. And the lesson won't be learned. And if she dies, we'll have to learn the lesson to someone else. So that step of stepping out of the social, but not in an irresponsible way, just stepping aside and saying, well, what's the heart doing with this? What's actually going on in my perceptions, my projections, whatever? What's actually going on with my mother? So that's very personal, and it's what we see looking at Dharma, looking at truth. So that's, I think, whether it's about love or anger, about joy or sorrow, It's looking at the heart in that way. That is just the beginning of, I think, Lokuttara practice, super mundane practice. Okay, so I've been observing this, and part of it I can see is like not wanting to admit into my mind. Pardon me for being very personal with this, but that's the only way I can talk. Part of it is for me is being the difficulty of admitting into consciousness any pain my mother has. Because as soon as I've been watching that, as soon as there's some discomfort or distress or worry or pain or whatever, my mind recoils, doesn't want to bring it into consciousness, and I worry. There's an inability, well, there isn't now. I think I've got it sussed. It's taken a while. But I could see as I watched this, as soon as there's the pain of the loved one, then there's the desire for the loved one not to have the pain, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's cups of tea and fluffing pillows and things like that. But one of the gimmicks we have in our human existence is pain, is sickness, is old age, is separation from the loved ones. This is a given. This is just part of the human condition. And I can see that if I can't, with anyone I love, if I can't admit into my heart and just feel what it, you know, that fear or that sorrow for someone suffering, then there's always a fear of admitting it into my mind, and I just keep worrying because I won't admit it to my mind. But I think the other has also happened to me, where I've admitted so much pain into my mind, worried so much, that it's become so painful, I've become so open, I just closed it all down with cynicism. I've done that one too. You know, where one takes on board so much pain, and one doesn't know how to go let it go through one's psyche, and then there's a refusal, so there's a kind of pushing away all the time of the sorrow of another. And that doesn't work either. So I think one thing, one has to be very, very present to life to understand these things. One has to be very, very present to the way the heart is operating with the people one loves. And one has to see that as a kind of laboratory, as an experiment. What actually happens now? Without judgment, without dismissal, without discussion, what happens? So I've seen in myself now that when I notice my mother suffering, and first of all, if I can bring up like reflections like, but this is old age is this way. Now, other mothers, their old age, I can take easily. I can give that advice to people ad nauseum. Oh, your mother's 86, it's natural. Where goes, my mother? Yeah, it's different. And this is the thing about the teaching. When it's someone else's mother, we can be very clever. Oh, it's all changing. We're all subject to death. That's a Nietzsche, you know. But when it comes to where it really hurts, that's where the teaching has to take place. Like, so do I really understand and take on board what it means, old age? Have I really taken that aboard? Or is it just a kind of Buddhist concept that I cleverly banter around in Dharma talks? Is it something that is heartfelt and understood in my own heart? So I can see that, say, with someone you really love, you know, you don't want them to suffer. But that's a given. With birth there's death. With birth there is the possibility of old age and the guarantee of sickness. It's a given. So the Buddhist teaching is trying to get us to make that conscious, but make it conscious not just in an abstract, intellectual way, but in a very visceral way, in a very kind of immediate way. I found that when my father was dying, caring for him, I was so lucky to actually be with him for that last month, because I could really see that he had cancer, he had to go through this. This is what he had to learn. And I had no choice. I had no choice. But seeing that and just watching my mind react, but being able to hold my mind on his pain, on his suffering, watching my own reaction, but keeping my heart open, I got through the attachment to worry, and I was actually much more compassionate. I wasn't just reacting from my own desire of how I wanted him to be. I was actually a sense of how he was. And I found actually that when he died, I was very, very peaceful, because I think I had kind of worked that through. But the difficulty was actually looking at the pain, feeling the pain. So, and say in Buddhist monasticism, I've just been reading a book that someone gave me on that. One of the reflections that we are asked to do is to reflect upon death. And so, like, traditionally, and I did this quite a bit in my early years as a monk, I would go to morgues and look at autopsies, which is something, you know, that we don't do in the West, because we went to England, we thought, well, let's go look at an autopsy. And we thought, well, they think we're a bunch of ghouls. You know, they'll arrest us. You know, it sounds very ghoulish, doesn't it? So like, we like teachings which are light and airy and soft and fluffy, you know, because they're nice. Heaven is beautiful and we'll all go to heaven, that kind of teaching. But the what I found, at least, that actually bringing to consciousness the human predicament, took like going, the story I like to tell, I went to an autopsy in Sri Raj Hospital, which was a was it's in Bangkok, and we usually went on a Monday if we were in town. I didn't live in Bangkok. We'd go on a Monday because Mondays when you had all the weekend traffic accidents and things. It'd be gruesome. And I'd say you'd go, and I remember this monk, he was about 40 years old, and he didn't, you know, there was no robes on him, he just told me he was a monk. And they cut his head open and looked at his brain. So they've got this hacksaw and they're hacking it, you know, really quite rough, it wasn't very sort of subtle. And they pop his, you know, they rip his face off first. Hope you haven't had dinner. Take his face off first, and wow, that's the face, he's gone. And then pop this open, take his brain out, look at his brain. And then his liver, and then his kidneys, and all that. And, you know, and what's the point of that? Why do that? Why not just be happy? Well, I found that like looking at that was very difficult. Really difficult to do. To keep my eye on it, because it was so repulsive. I asked the doctor, what did he die of? He said, oh, brain hemorrhage, he thought too much. I mean, well, better be careful. But just kind of learning to actually hold, like what was very difficult was touching it. Because I thought I'd get that stuff called death. He said, don't touch it, you know, that kind of feeling. So I just hope, like touching the body and the coldness of it and that. But what I found is I was going towards that which I didn't want. I was going towards that which I was afraid of and repelled by, but not I was going towards it quite mindful with awareness. It actually brought a lot of peace to the mind. And this is, I think, also what I found with being with my mother. When I can accept into consciousness that which I don't want her to experience, I know there's pain and the things that she goes through, when I allow that to be there, certainly there's a reaction, oh, I don't want that. But if I'm aware of that, it goes through my mind, and then my mind is actually much more compassionate and much more peaceful. And the thing about the practices of Buddhist compassion, they are about peace. They say that when they talk about compassion in the various heart states, they talk about the near enemy and the far enemy. So the near enemy of compassion, they say, is anger or cruelty. So that's obvious. The opposite of compassion is cruelty. So if you're a cruel person, you try to practice compassion. But they say the near enemy of compassion is worry and despair. And you can see that, you know, how when you really love someone, that you can very easily worry about them dying and getting sick. Because what? Because it can happen, even if they're healthy. Because that's one of the givens. One of the givens is that we will die, and we will get sick. Huh? And some of us might live to be old. Or some of us are old. Alright? That's a given. And I think modern culture, youth culture, consumer culture, distracted culture, does not want to make that conscious. You know, it's not something you do. You don't talk about that. You cover it over. You kind of make the corpse very pretty. And what the Buddha's teaching is trying to make that a much more conscious thing, so that there isn't this kind of background of fear which drives our lives, which conditions our lives. Because when we make something conscious, and when we're fully aware of it, it doesn't influence us subliminally, subconsciously, when we make it fully conscious. I remember this is one of the first teachings I heard from Ajahn Sumedho, that a consciousness is the escape hatch. So say, like being with my mother, you know, the feeling of don't suffer. When I made that conscious and I let that through my mind, and I saw, and it took me a long time to see that because the reaction would be so quick, and I kept watching it. Then I felt, when that actually went through me with full mindfulness, then I felt actually quite a very open, sensitive, and actually joyous heart. Not because I was happy that she's suffering, because I was more with that. I was more with that. Many of the people that kind of come into Buddhism now that I meet are my age, so it's sort of baby boomers, aren't we? Baby boomers. And so many of us, our parents are either gone or that age, and many of us are feeling older, or at least the body is, so not as flexible and so on and so forth. And if that's not recognized, if that's dismissed, then there's always that fear, isn't there? Or worry about that. So to take care of the body and so on, but actually to recognize, well, this is a formation in nature. It's not mine. Somehow there is kind of incarnate consciousness in it, sure. But I don't own it. It's nature's body, right? It's nature's body, and nature has laws, and those laws are, with birth, there's death. That's a given. And rather than trying to ignore that, to actually kind of make conscious the kind of just the aging of the body. Oh, this is what it feels to be 54. Do more yoga. more yoga more often. Now, say like with family especially, fear and worry, like in the Metta Sutta that we chant here quite often, the example we're given is that the love that we're asked to develop is the love that a mother has for her child. Now we're asked to develop that for all beings, which is a rather extraordinary request. And yet, when you look at that, the love that a mother has for a child, it can be so fraught with worry, so fraught with fear, huh? And vice versa for the child, for the parent. So, this is the kind of, I think, the big challenge of love is, how can I not get caught up into those worrisome, fearful states? And what I have to do is, first of all, I really notice how I keep projecting into the future. So I can see, say, with my mother, and when I notice some kind of distress in her, then if I'm not attentive, I grab that and I project it into the future. And my mind is in the future. It's going to happen. And if I'm not aware of that, I'm always living in this kind of tension. What's going to happen? This might happen, that might happen. And I'm not aware, I'm not in the present moment. But if I can just awaken to that tension, and I can bring myself back to the present moment, right? Then what I notice the tension in my face, I notice the tension in my heart, I notice my thought patterns, and I notice what I'm creating around the future. The future, we spend so much time rehearsing the future, don't we? You know, life is a rehearsal. But it's never that way. It's never that way. So why do we do that? Why do we rehearse the future? Because we think by sufficient rehearsal, you know, we'll give a good performance. But when life comes the way it comes, we have to give the performance that we're asked to give, and it's never the rehearsal. So worry is this kind of perverse way of actually not facing fear. Worry is a kind of perverse way of dealing with fear. Worry is a perverse way of not admitting that into your consciousness, trying to sort things out. And it becomes a kind of addiction. So, and it is an addiction because it might happen, certainly. The future is unknown, it's uncertain. So my teacher, he's always stressing uncertainty. My practice is going well, it's uncertain. Thanks. No encouragement, thanks a lot. So he would not give you any grounding. I had a really great insight. I think I've made it. It's uncertain. Huh? He'd even do things like, say we'd come to his monastery just before the rains retreat, And he wouldn't tell you which monastery you're going to be at for the next 3 months. And then there'd be this kind of cattle auction, and finally he'd say, well, you're going there. You'd have it like two hours to pack, and you're off to a monastery for 4 months, a place you don't even know. So there's always this kind of training and uncertainty. Now why? It wasn't to make us worried, but he would just kind of say, your only ground is in the moment. This is only, the only certainty you have is right now, because that's the only thing happening. Huh? And learn to deal with this moment now. See the projection in the future. Learn to find peace in this moment now, rather than projecting the future. Now that doesn't mean that we don't have social responsibility. So we have that. So we can plan, and we can think about the future in terms of planning. But you'll never get certainty through planning, will you? You can't, because life is uncertain. So actually, the Buddhist way is to actually make uncertainty conscious, make that really uncertain. I have a friend who's giving a talk right now, right? And he's unemployed, and there's a lot of uncertainty in his life. So on the one hand, he has to work very hard to try to get a job, right? And on the other hand, he has to accept uncertainty into the heart. So when you have like a time now where there's a lot of unemployment, a lot of uncertainty that way, and a lot of fear that way, or warfare, whatever, that really plays up on the uncertainty. So what Buddhism is saying is like, do everything you can to be certain, like definitely get a good pension plan, right? Make sure your mortgage payments are paid. Don't just shave your head and go off to be a monastery because you might not like it. You know, think about the future. Right? Don't be silly. Think about the future. Think about your kids' education and all that. And realize it's uncertain. So without dismissing the very real need to be world-wise, don't rely on that to get rid of your fears, because it won't. The pension plan will not get rid of your fears. It will to a certain extent. It will give you some kind of security. Obviously, if you're a bag lady in the middle of Ottawa, it's going to be a bit tougher, you know, with your health care, whatever. So do that, but see that the end of fear, the end of worry, has to come through contemplation and meditation. It doesn't come through some kind of social framework. But on the other hand, don't be naive, don't be silly, don't be stupid. Like, be wise, be clever, be frugal with money or whatever. I had one friend who was, he has a incredible superstitious mind, unfortunately for him. And he has an astrologer in Asia who he really trusts. Now this astrologer said he was going to win the sweepstakes, or the lotto in New Zealand. He actually went and bought a TV before he won. And of course he didn't win. That's stupid, isn't it? That's really stupid. So, like, how can I be quite careful about the worldly dharmas, but also how can I find freedom and the end of worry through the spiritual practice? You need both, you know. So like monasteries, we have all kinds of rules, and we have our committee has a four-month reserve for the payment of things. So we do all those things. But where is the end of worry? It's not by trying to find certainty in the uncertain. That we call stupidity. If you try to find certainty in the uncertain, you're always going to suffer. So the teaching is always like Ajahn Chah would teach, that this is a broken cup. And you'd say, no, it's not. It's got water in it. No, it's a broken cup. Inherent in that cup is brokenness. And once you accept that into the mind, then you take care of it, and you don't bump it, and you don't crash it. And then one day someone crashes it, and you say, that's the way it's supposed to be. It's inherent, it's broken, right? So it's supposed to be. A watch, a body. And bringing that into those, and that's all right with a cup, unless you really like that cup. But bringing it into the nitty-gritty of the things that we really love and treasure and don't want to lose, that's where it's difficult. But that's where it's also most edifying. You find the place of, you know, you find the, clean counter where the dirty counter is. And those are the areas, of course, we don't want to enter into. So sometimes I meet people who haven't really looked at that. Say I've seen people in very strong marriages, and they've kind of ignored that. Even Buddhists, right to the end, beautiful marriage for 40 years, and then it's a surprise when the partner dies, when the husband dies, when the wife dies, and there's this massive depression. Now, sure, there's a massive depression, because if you've lived with someone for 40 years, that's going to be a pretty rough change. But somehow that hasn't really been contemplated, that this marriage is really impermanent. This is a broken cup. Not as a morbid kind of negative pessimism. Like, pessimism is just thinking the worst possibility. The cup will break, the cup will break, the cup will break, the cup will break, the cup. That's pessimism. Right? Stupidity is, it's permanent, it's permanent, it's permanent. Dharma is inherent in that cup, is brokenness. Let's take care of it. It's a nice cup. Be careful with it. Be mindful of it. Take care of your body. Take care of your family. Take care of your relationship. Right? So it's not just like, look at like pessimism, cynicism, all those states of mind. It's just bad thinking. It's just going down the tube. My family's going down the tube. My kids argued with me today. What's going on, the state of the world, you know? It's not like it used to be when kids respected their parents and, the mind's just going on in one endless sort of the litany of negativity, right? That's not reflection on the Dharma of impermanence. That's the litany of negativity. That's unskillfulness. That's not Dharma. That's just wrong thinking. Worry. My kids, what's going to happen to them? My kids studying electronic engineering, and Silicon Valley's going down the tube. Maybe they took the wrong profession, and I've invested $100,000 into their life. And that's not Dharma. That's wrong thinking. Life is lovely. There'll be, it'll always be good. But that's not Dharma. That's optimism. But Dharma is that, what is the nature of our existence? With birth, there is death. That which has the nature to arise is the nature to cease. And trying to really put that into our lives. So we say that, like, the problem of human suffering is rooted in ignorance. Right? And ignorance is what? Seeing in the impermanence, seeing permanence. Right? So seeing in happiness, permanence. So we say happiness is unsatisfactory. And people don't like that when they say, what do you mean, happiness is suffering? That's not true. Happiness is happiness. But happiness is unsatisfactory in the sense that when it's there, great, but you can't rely on it. Right? So when it's there, be grateful. And if you know the factors for happiness, fine. Perpetuate them. But don't rely on worldly happiness. So when happiness changes, say like harmony in the family, or harmony in monasteries, or harmony whatever, great. Lovely. Do everything we can for harmony. But when it changes to disharmony, we can contemplate the factors and try to bring harmony back, make our contribution, but that's the way it's supposed to change. Harmony is a broken cup. It can't always be permanent. So when there's disharmony in the family, in the monastery, well, you kind of... Like, if you find that in monasteries, like, that's my experience in monasteries, they're this kind of... They're like... waves, surf, like surfing, just crashing, and everything's going really well, and people are ordaining, and there's, people are making donations to the monastery, and things are being built, and then there isn't enough money to pay for the electricity, and everyone's disrobing, and people hate the abbot, and they don't like Buddhism, they want to take up psychotherapy, and then it's all going through the tubes, and then you have meetings, we've got to do this, and we've got to do that, yeah, you're right, and then somehow it changes, and people are there again, and they love Buddhism, and they think the Ajahn's great, I've been at it for a while now. I've seen this cycle a few times. And now when the young monks kind of come at you and say, oh, it's falling apart, Bhante. Yeah, it's falling apart. It's what it's supposed to be. It's just the way it is. So I mean, not to be in denial or dismiss the real problems that any community has, but to expect it to always be hunky dory, kind of on upward climb. Yes, yes, yes. We're off to, you know, Buddhism's going to take over the world and so on. No. I was thinking today, like, maybe Buddhism is just a kind of baby boomer phenomena. You know, maybe in 50 years they'll all be playing the casinos. I don't know. But is that my problem? Should I worry about Buddhism in 50 years' time? It'll take care of itself. It's bigger than me. So when we can see that there is no real security in that which changes. There's no security in my mother always being happy. I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? There's no security in that. So when she is unhappy, you say, yeah, but that's the way it's supposed to be. I'm still open. It's not dismissive. Oh, yeah, you're supposed to be unhappy. Just dump it on her. I could still crack jokes and try to create a good situation. But if I accept it into consciousness, then I don't create, I'm not the one that creates worry and negativity and whining and all that. I'm a force for stability, for Dharma. But that, I mean, it's a very hard lesson for me. I can talk in kind of flippant ways about it. But actually the doing of that I found very difficult because it is so painful. It's so terribly painful to see that. But if I make that conscious and I'm aware of it, and I don't shy away from it, it's like that corpse, you know, that I do. And I'm willing to go into something which I don't want to look at. I'm willing to touch the coldness of the body. I'm willing to make death a conscious experience. Then it's not a problem. Because I've integrated into my understanding of life. It's a part of it's the dharmic way, the way things are. Obviously, like the death of someone very elderly is a lot easier than death of someone very young. I mean, if someone young dies in one's family or something kind of like WTC or so on, those are much, much, much more traumatic things to experience and so on. And it takes more time, but the principle is the same. The principle is willing to take the wholeness of life, both birth and death, because that's the deal. You know, that's just the deal of being here. And it does make us more human, because we are more conscious. We're not just being kind of silly consumers in some kind of youth culture. Where the values of, you know, like those commercials are always about young people having a great time drinking a Pepsi. Right? So somehow, you know, you cork this bottle and you'll have all of that. If only, right? But life is obviously a more profound kind of proposition. So just in closing, I would, you know, just suggest maybe like, In your family and in your work situations, you have things like this that are ongoing, right? And because they're ongoing, they are in some sense ongoing pain that you're working with. But they're also where you get a lot of insight because, say, the understandings now I have around love and worry, and love and fear and worry and things like that with my mother, are really deep understandings that apply to everything. They're not just about my mother, are they? There's something about the deep understanding of love and attachment, how that works. And that attachment doesn't have to be a cold, sterile experience. You know, I mean, non-attachment. So, we have this word non-attachment. People mean non-attachment. Oh, gosh, that means I can't like anything. Sorry, Mom, I can't talk with you. which is absurd. But does non-attachment mean a life lived in kind of cold polar cynicism? No. Because the teaching also says the metta, karuna, mudita, you know, talks about that. And about kindness, compassion, joy, talks about this. So the Buddhist teaching does point to a very profound, open-hearted experience of non-attachment. But the hardest one probably is what we call upekkha, or equanimity. And upekkha or equanimity, the fourth of the what we call the Brahma Viharas or the divine abidings, is not coldness. You know, this is equanimity sounds very cold, but the others are there. So what is like equanimity when I see my mom's pain? What is equanimity there? Does that mean that I say, I laugh? No. Does that mean I don't experience it? It's not worry. But it's actually being fully with the feeling of pain, but not creating more around it. That's equanimity. So it's an open-hearted acceptance of the way things are, and you have to trust in that. It does work. So I always say, it doesn't work. It does work. Open-heart acceptance, you let it into your heart, and the mind has peace because you've let it into your heart. Resisting it cannot lead to peace, because then there's always that resistance, because there's always that possibility. And so in our lives, in those ongoing close relationships that we have with life, which are so beautiful but can be painful, there is a great chance for understanding something very fundamental about the heart. You go very deep in the heart. And then those lessons are powerful for all the other relationships that we have. If you are familiar with the scriptural basis of the